Tony heard the drone before he saw it, a distant rushing noise, somewhere between a hum and a hiss, rather like the sound inside a seashell. It was the same sound he'd heard on his first night out in the wilderness that he'd taken for a waterfall, and it seemed to be growing louder and more distinct as he picked his way down the mountainside, now seeming more like a buzz, now seeming almost particulate, a kind of clatter curving up into a whine. He'd returned to the national park intending to retrace the route he'd taken over the weekend, but more than 3 hours had passed since he'd left the track along the ridge, and he was yet to see any landmark that he recognized. The rushing sound was the only sign that he was anywhere near the place he'd bivouacked on Friday night. And he began, not quite consciously, to direct his steps towards it, fully expecting to step over a fallen tree trunk or push aside a curtain of vines and come upon a sudden spring, white rapids over mossy stones perhaps, a chasm cut and shaped by decades of cascading water, a torrent gushing noisily into a pool. The bush around him was too dense to be able to see more than 50 or so meters in any direction, and he was just wondering if he ought to get out his phone and try for a signal when he emerged onto a little bluff with views out over the Kottawai Basin. And he saw, sweeping back and forth over the treetops, a sleek-looking quadricopter drone. He stood watching it fly for almost a minute, hearing Owen Darvish in his head.
"It's called an airborne magnetic and radiometric survey," Darvish had told him. "And they do it from way, way up, thousands of meters up."
This drone was barely 50 meters up, but for all Tony knew, it was carrying out some sort of task that could only be achieved close to the ground. Its movement was too methodical for him to think that it was being used for recreation. It looked to him like it was combing the area for something. Tony glanced around him at the view, discovering, to his relief, that he could orient himself by the shape of the ranges on the far side of the basin. He wasn't lost. He'd just overshot again. The research site lay off to his right, not out in front of him, as he'd supposed, but a little to the north and west of where the drone was currently patrolling. Before heading into the national park that morning, Tony had driven into Thorndyke to charge his devices and replenish his supplies. The chip shop didn't open till the afternoon, but when he'd bought a basket's worth of groceries at the petrol station, the attendant had agreed to let him use a PowerPoint in the far corner of the store. Sitting on the dusty linoleum beside the drinks cabinet, his phone plugged into his laptop plugged into the wall, Tony had searched the terms radiometric survey, autonomo, and drone, typing with one hand, the other holding his dictaphone to his ear, and replaying at low volume his conversation with Darvish, who, it would seem, had been correct. Geophysical surveys were indeed conducted from the air, and they were indeed one of the services Autonomo provided to clients around the world. What was more, Tony read, Autonomo had carried out a comprehensive survey of New Zealand back in 2010, as part of a dubious exploratory stocktake of the country's mineral resources on conservation land. The survey had been commissioned by the government, and its brief, Tony read, had been to identify mineral deposits of economic interest and to put a likely cost on their extraction. At the time, the government had been considering a law change to allow mining in New Zealand's national parks. Tony remembered this proposition very well, not only because he had been one of the thousands who had marched against it. He had dressed as a coal-blackened chimney sweep, carrying a placard that bore the word mine with a line through it, and below it, the word ours. But also because its defeat ranked among the very few decisive victories for protest action in his lifetime. In the face of public outcry, the proposal had eventually been scrapped. He was smiling as he downloaded the report in order to skim the introduction, pleased that Lemoyne's connection to New Zealand had such an unsavory pedigree, and pleased that his essay would now have reason to mention and celebrate a recent triumph for democracy and for the left. For once in Tony's life, the privatizing maniacs in power had been impeded. For once in his life, the greed and degradation of their placating free market dogma had been exposed for what it was. The victory was so delicious to remember that Tony had been almost disappointed when he reached the part of the report that dealt with Kottawai to learn that no deposits of economic interest had been discovered anywhere near Thorndyke or the Kottawai Pass. Frowning, he had gone back to Google to ask what scientific research was currently being undertaken in the national park, trying to join the dots somehow between the fact of the Autonomo Commission and what the guard had said to him on Saturday morning. But despite trying every search term and every combination he could think of, he had come up empty-handed. He could find nothing to suggest that any research of any kind was taking place in Kottawai at all. That was odd.
Kodawai was public land. Something should have been out in the public domain. Something should have been searchable online. Because something was definitely going on in Kodawai. He'd seen it for himself. He took a breath and held it. Could the report that he was reading have been faked? Tony had no difficulty whatsoever in believing the New Zealand government capable of rank conspiracy. What was the cabinet anyway, he thought, his indignation rising, but a cabal of millionaire property tycoons who had spent their time in office beefing up their personal stock portfolios and actively discouraging the populace from turning out to vote? Most of them could hardly even breathe without lying. Certainly none of them had any respect whatsoever for the principle of public ownership. Had they not flagrantly ignored the result of a referendum on basically this very issue just a few years prior, selling off a tranche of publicly owned assets in spite of the fact that the New Zealand public, to whom the assets rightfully belonged, had voted to retain them? Exposing a billionaire would have been sweet, Tony thought, his imagination running ahead of himself somewhat. But exposing his own government, the New Zealand government, supposedly so green, so clean, and so famously inoffensive, that would be so much sweeter. He was grinning again as he disconnected his devices and packed his cords away. Forget Burnham Wood, he thought, nodding goodbye to the station attendant and going outside to unlock Veronica's car. Forget the bunker. Forget everything he'd planned to write about survivalism and growth hacking and techno-futurism and imperial stage capitalist decline and New Zealand's pathetically obsequious courting of the super rich. Forget all of that. This was his story. He couldn't quite see the whole picture yet, but a picture was undoubtedly forming. Whatever was going on in Kodawai was going on in secret, and he, Tony Gallo, Anthony Gallo, was going to be the one to flush it out. He kept watching the drone, enjoying its motion as it coasted back and forth, sailing towards him, then away, towards him, then away. Presently he blinked and saw another, flying lower and faster than the first. And then he blinked again and realized all at once that the basin was absolutely swarming with them, all moving independently of one another, as though each had a mind of its own. Some dipping down into the trees and up again, others circling, still others hovering in place. Tony felt a mounting curiosity. He set down his backpack and took out his binoculars for a closer look, remembering the trailer-mounted mobile phone mast that he'd come across on Saturday morning, and wondering if the purpose of the mast could be to furnish the drones with a wireless charge. His attention snagged on something right in the middle of his field of view, and he raised the lenses to his eyes to see a drone hanging in the air right in front of him, startlingly magnified, shimmering with heat, propellers thrumming. And although the black dome of the camera housing that hung between the skids was opaque, the glass so polished it seemed almost wet, Tony had no doubt whatsoever that the machine had seen him, that it was seeing him, assessing him in real time. His heart was thumping, but he kept the binoculars to his eyes and calmly panned away from it, moving slowly, acting as though he hadn't noticed anything unusual. He focused on a clump of trees in the middle distance instead, panned across those for a moment or two, then yawned, stood up, and put the binoculars back in his bag. He did a couple of languid stretches, shouldered his backpack, and ambled off into the bush the way he'd come. He was soon swallowed up by the trees, but he kept walking at what he hoped would seem like a contented pace, until the noise of the drones behind him began to fall away. Then, still not daring to look back, he broke into a run, moving as fast as he could through the ferny undergrowth, scrambling over roots and fallen trees, pushing through vines and branches, and avoiding as much as possible the ribs of sunlight that came slanting down through the canopy in rays of olive and sea green. After half a kilometre or so, he turned sharply to his left and diverted his course downhill, doubling back on himself until he reached the bottom of the bluff where he'd been standing, and then altered his course again, heading to his right, into the heart of the Kodawai Basin. He was scanning for shelter as he went, and presently he came upon a giant totara tree that had fallen against the crook of its neighbour, pulling up a massive clump of roots and soil to form a kind of earthy amphitheatre in the forest floor. He ducked into the cavity, rolled onto his stomach, and then peered out at ground level, breathing hard, his heartbeat thudding in his ears. He could see the fence. It was about 50 paces from where he was hiding, close enough for him to read the plastic signs that warned, at regular intervals, "Research in progress. Please keep out." He lay motionless until his breathing returned to normal, and he was satisfied he hadn't been pursued. Then, moving as quietly and efficiently as he could, he opened his backpack and took out his balaclava and a pair of over trousers. He put these on, checking that the cuffs were tight around his gaiters, and then pulled on a pair of woolen gloves as well. He had once attended a digital obfuscation workshop hosted by a civil liberties awareness group, and he knew that the drone's thermal imaging technology would have a harder time detecting him through insulated clothing, and the trees would help to disperse his heat signature. And it was daytime, which would help even more. Thermal imaging worked much better at night, when the air was cooler and the contrast with the human body was more pronounced. He remembered that it had been raining the first time he had entered the national park. Perhaps that was why the guard had seemed so surprised to see him the following morning. He looked down the length of his body, thinking he was probably as safe as he could make himself. But then, having second thoughts, he took off his red jacket and exchanged it for a darker colored fleece, tucking the hem of the fleece into the waistband of his trousers. Every inch of his body was now covered, except for the slot over his eyes. He was just wondering whether he dared to climb out of the hollow and go to investigate the fence when he heard heavy footsteps clumping through the undergrowth nearby and saw two men approaching, both wearing black puffer jackets, one fiddling with a flat handheld device, a control pad of some sort, and the other scanning the trees around them in a practiced sweeping motion, keeping a lookout as they walked. Tony shrank back into the shadow, but the guard was glancing around at eye level, not scanning the forest floor. His gaze passed smoothly over the hollow where Tony was hiding.
"Anything?"
he said to the man with the control pad, who shook his head and said,
"Waste of time, he was going the other way."
The first man nodded, and several seconds later they were gone. They were looking for him. In his head, Tony saw his byline, imagined himself interviewed, heard the intro music for a podcast, a plucky glockenspiel, a shimmering undertow of strings. They were looking for him. They were on the alert. He'd seen three guys so far. There could be more. It would be senseless to try for the fence now. Forgetting over it was one thing. He also had to think about getting out again. Better to wait a day or two, he thought. Let them think he'd left the area, undertake a spot of surveillance of his own. This hollow was as good a camp as any. A little spidery, maybe, but safe. He'd stay put, monitor the fence line, get a sense of their rhythms and routines, start keeping a diary, start making a plan. Tony was grinning underneath his balaclava. Everything that he was doing, running from the drones, hiding out in the hollow, layering up, employing obfuscation tactics, these were the kinds of details that were going to make his story great. He was moving on instinct, following his hunches, living in the moment, using everything at his disposal in his pursuit of truth. He was risking his life for his investigation. He was a part of the story. He was the story. Still grinning, Tony allowed himself one last fantasy. He saw himself on stage, at a podium, collecting an award. He probably shouldn't use his phone for a while either. That was a pity. It would have been nice to have got in touch with Rosie, just to let her know that he was really onto something, and to fill her in. But he was already shaking his head. Rosie was nice, but, well, but that was just it, really. She was nice. She was the kind of girl who trusted in her government, a good upstanding citizen who played by the rules and took people at face value, and made it a point of pride to give everyone she met the benefit of the doubt. She wasn't a radical. If he told her what he suspected might be going on here, Tony thought, she'd only humor him. She'd agree that it sounded super crazy and super dodgy and super weird, but she wouldn't really mean it. She wouldn't believe that a government conspiracy was even possible, not in New Zealand, not in 2017. She wouldn't understand the danger he was in, wouldn't appreciate the risks, wouldn't really comprehend the scale of it. And Tony wasn't in the mood to be patronized. Anyway, he thought, as he took out his notebook and uncapped his fountain pen, he'd already told her that he was going to be out of range for a few days. She wouldn't be expecting him to get in touch. And it wasn't like she was even his girlfriend. He opened his notebook to a clean page.
"I heard the drones before I saw them," he wrote.
And then he sat back, held up his notebook like a hymnal, and in a whisper, said the words aloud.